It's a privilege for me. Please forgive my voice. I have all this last week been smoking Camel'd unfiltered cigarettes. Just took up that habit, and thank you for laughing at that joke. It's a very lame joke. Now, I've been speaking a lot, and I don't know if you noticed, in California, they have a little thing called allergies, and that combination has really made this challenging for me. My friend is with me here tonight, Dr. Kent McCorkle. Kent is a doctor of chemistry from, well, actually, he's a campus pastor. He, you know, spent the thousands of dollars, wrote the dissertation. They put the hood on him. Then he said, okay, enough chemistry. I'm going to help students. So, but you know, if you do all that studying, you should call him doctor. So that's Mr. Dr. Kent McCorkle back there, my buddy. Tonight, we've got a really incredible topic. And before we get into kind of the meat of it, I want to tell you a little story about my own experience in the world of male-female relationships. And most of you will know in this room, Glenn's been going on the seven deadly sin. So I call up Glenn and I said, hey, Glenn, you know, I'm going to be in the area. And boy, I'd love to have a chance to be at the Chi Alpha meeting again. He's like, oh, wow, we'd want you to speak. But the thing is, we're going to stay on our series. So you'll have to take one of the seven deadly sins. And I was like, which one? He's like, lust. And I was like, thanks. Appreciate that. wow, you're a good friend, I think. So, but actually, it's a topic I love to talk on. I do a lot of national, I travel around the whole nation and do open air, open dorm Q&A with students. And of course, the topic of sexual ethics is the second most frequently asked type of question that I get. And so we talk about it. And I always start off by saying my basic bottom line response in the whole area of sexuality, temptation, lust, male, female, all that, the whole big ball of ethics and everything in it. The bottom line place I want to start with all that is from a minister of almost 20 years who is very, very serious about my relationship with God. I want to just say, sex, yay. I'm a fan of sex. I think it's a good thing. Overall, I think, wow, good job, God. But it is a very intense thing. And that's where you get into the area of lust. It's a very, very intense thing. You know, I always tell people that sex is a lot like nuclear energy. When used for good, it powers the whole country of France. when used for bad, it creates leukemia for four generations in Russia. You know what I'm saying? So you have Chernobyl on one hand. You have, you know, pretty safe nuclear program in France on the other hand. And so it's got potential for great good and potential for great bad because it's a powerful thing. Anything that's powerful, when handled correctly, is a very awesome thing. And of course, when handled incorrectly, is a very dangerous thing. And sexuality is like this. It's a very, very powerful thing. How many here remember your first crush? You're full on first. The first girl I had a crush on, her name was Jeanine Connors. And what I really liked about her was the back of her head and the fact that she helped me with algebra homework. And she sat in front of me in algebra. Let's see if I can break this table before the night's over.
Actually, I think you might be breaking my $300 electronic device.
Oh, really? Oh, I'm not sitting on it. I can feel it. So the thing about it is with Jeanine, she sat right in front of me in algebra. And for like 2 weeks, I didn't say a word to her because I was so, you know, enamored with her. But I just stared at the back of her head. I'm like, that's the most gorgeous back of a head I've ever seen. And then when I finally did talk to her, she helped me with algebra, which made her even a more wonderful human being. But the first time I really, that was kind of a little flirty thing, but the first time I really, really fell head over heels for someone was this girl named Brenda. Now, the thing about Brenda was she was not from my high school, which was a great advantage to me in this one area. She had no idea what a dork I was because she wasn't from my high school. And so we met at this leadership camp and I was able to pull off not being a dork for 3 days in a row, which was a personal record at that time. And she was like, oh, this guy's a nice guy. I've got her fooled. Yes. And so then she was like, her high school was like a mile down the road from mine. And so we ended up started hanging out. And then it got to that uncomfortable moment where we're like, we're hanging out so much. It's like, what are we? And we had that, you know, conversation, the significant, you know, defining relationship conversation. And I can remember, you know, she was like, yes, we are something. I would like to actually be associated with you in a relational way. I was like, ah, you know, And I can remember the first date we went on after, you know, kind of defining it. And you guys, some of you guys are so experienced in this area by the time you were like 17, 18 that it's not even funny. But I, having fully both received and manifested the dork gene in my life, you know, this was like a major breakthrough for me. And so I can remember I wanted the date to be just perfect. And we're going to go to the drive-in and we're going to go out to dinner.
Just keep talking.
And so, first of all, I borrowed my mom's car, which was a Honda Civic. It was just like the greatest car ever, I just thought. And cleaned the whole car up, got my best blue jeans on. You know, that one pair, I don't know if you have that one pair of blue jeans. It's like, you got to have that pair of blue jeans if you're going to do something important. Put that pair on. And so I go over to her house, and she's having a party. Her dad's having a birthday party at her house. Now, her dad was a teacher. So every teacher I know, like in the county, is there. And her younger sister answers the door. This is a loser situation. Because the younger sister, of course, is looking for every opportunity to completely embarrass. So she opens the door and screams in the house to every single teacher in the county, Brenda, your new boyfriend's here! You know, I'm like, oh no. She comes, we get in the car, and we go to the drive-in. And the drive-in, the movie, you guys wouldn't even know this reference because you're so young, but it's a Cheech and Chong movie. Oh, you do know that reference. How even more embarrassing for me. And this is a hideous movie. We suffer through this stupid movie. And we go to the river afterwards. There's a river in our town, and we're walking through down the path of the river. And we're talking. Next thing I know, I look, and it is like hecka late. And my mom is really like, you got to get the car home by this time. You got to get the car. So I'm like, I got to go. Come on, let's get in the car. We rush back to her house. And you got to picture the scene at her house. We're walking, and she's got this little fence in her front yard that's about that big, framing her front yard. And there's this little path. And then there's the porch. Then there's a front door. And above the porch is the master bedroom where her mom and dad are up there asleep. And so I walk down the path and we get to the front door. And of course, our whole conversation that night has been her telling me how incredible I am and me telling her how incredible she is. You know how that is at the beginning stage of a relationship. And so we get to the end of this thing and she's like, oh, Kurt, the one thing I really want you to know and just really important for you to know is I just really want to tell you, man, you are such a good hugger. Now, they say that memories are formed by two things. Their emotional content, how emotionally intense they are, and how much actual information your body kind of takes in that moment. So a memory that involves lots of sensory information, you know, you're getting a lot of stimuli visually or touch or taste, plus is very emotion to you, that memory will sear itself in your brain more than, say, oh, I don't know, an art history lecture at 8 a.m. And so, you know, the thing about it is, I went into this experience not knowing that theory, not understanding any of that, but boy, did I experience that because I was such a chicken. I thought, well, you know, I'll hug her, but I'm not going to kiss her. But if she would like to kiss me, I'll leave my lips in that proximity. And then, you know, give her that opportunity if she so would. And so we hug and we part and there's that moment where we're just right there. And she leans in. Here I am, geeky 17-year-old boy, has no idea what to do about anything. And we lean in and she just gives me this nicest, so awesome. Let me say this. There's a lot of nerve endings in your lips, which makes them quite dangerous things. Because, man, these things can take in a lot of data. These things called lips. Lips are dangerous. They really are. She leans in and kisses me, and it's just like, yes! And then, just a moment. It wasn't like what you see on the movies nowadays where it's Attack of the Killer Tongue, you know, you know, wasn't one of those. Excuse me. But then she just kisses me, okay? And we part, and she says, good night, Kurt. And I said, it's literally what I said. I was like, oh. And I started walking backwards down the porch. Yeah, exactly. There's a little garden hose across the path. Now, here's the thing that you have to understand about the porch and the garden hose is that there are really two ways that the human body trips. One way is where you just immediately lose your balance. You fall to the ground. Bam! You trip. You look stupid. The little things were showing it ahead of time. Oh, don't worry about it. No, I was talking about the movies they were playing before. People were tripping. That's, you just, bam, you trip. And how many have ever tripped that way? It's just, you tripped, and it's done, it's over, it's horrible. I did this once where I was going on my bike, and I was trying to decide which path to take. And it was like, this is the short way, but it's dangerous, and this is the long way, but I'm late. And I'm riding, you ever had that going to class? You know, and I couldn't decide. And the last minute, I'm like, no, I'm going to go the long way. And I went like this. And if you would have been looking from a distance, it would have looked like I was just riding my bike, and I just went, I hate that stop sign. Because I literally just hit this. See, I say this in churches. People don't know what I'm talking about. But students that ride bikes, they're like, dude, I was there. I was right there. So anyway, bam, we hit this thing. Go back. I got the other story. Go back to the story. So I'm walking down the stairs. There are two ways to trip. One is you just boom, you fall down, you look stupid, which is what I did on the bike. The second way is your body, for whatever reason, I believe that your body does possess some sort of rudimentary, primitive intelligence. And I base this completely on the anecdotal information that every once in a while my body will think it knows better than my brain. And so my brain would never do this, but my body does. It says, oh, we're tripping. That will look embarrassing. I'm going to save Kurt from looking embarrassing by quickly running backwards and flailing my arms to catch my momentum so I won't trip and look stupid. The only problem with this body strategy is you already have looked. And so I go down the thing, my heel hits this garden hose, and I start going, all the way to the fence, which I trip over to hit the garbage cans to wake up the dog, who pounces on me and bites my thumb so that the dad throws open the window upstairs. What is going on? All of this because of the power of lips. Lips are a powerful, freaky thing. Here's the bottom line. If you look at lust in the Bible, you will find about 700 references actually to the Hebrew and Greek word for lust. Now, besides references to the word lust, there is a whole bunch of themes. So even beyond the 700 times, which is a pretty hefty amount of content, there's also these storylines. So even though you might not have the specific word lust, lust is something that really touches almost every single major story in the Bible. And what is lust? Lust is very similar to sloth and greed, and it deals in the realm of bodily appetites. If you look at phrases in the Bible that deal, and the stories in the Bible that deal with lust, it'll say words like inflamed. It'll say words like I'm trying to think of some of the other descriptive words. It'll say they were inflamed. It'll say God gave them over to their lusts. Oh, great. He says that their lust poured out, and they were in lusty defilement, and they had lustful desires, and they gave them over to shameful lust. The idea of this is that lust is sort of like a normal, natural bodily appetite gone steroid. Lust is normal human sexuality gone WWF wrestling. That's basically what lust is. In fact, if you look at all of the body appetites, there is a parameter for them. And sexuality is no different. In sloth, I'm sure that you talked about this, there is this parameter that's somewhere between Sabbath and workaholic. In gluttony, there's this parameter having an eating disorder and worshiping food. And in the middle of that parameter is the normal, healthy function for human beings. Sexuality is the same way. Lust is the expression of human sexuality when it is uncontrolled, when it's unredeemed. It's sexuality that has no parameters. Okay? It's a normal bodily appetite. The reason I say that is because I run into two types of Christians. The first type of Christian will deal with sexuality in a way that looks extremely similar to if you're not a Christian at all. I meet Christians all the time. The way they interact with people in a sexual level has very little difference to how people that are not Christians interact. Then I'll run over on this side, and I meet Christians that are so proof that Freud was right, because they're so repressed, it's not even funny. You start talking about sex, and they're like, sex? You know, it's like, oh, take out my little shark. I thought I had a sexual thought. Oh, good, okay. Negative reinforcement. Get away from me. This is especially amazing to me among 20-somethings, because guess what? Biologically speaking, this is the moment in life where you probably should be looking for a mate, most of you. This is a good moment to do that. Now, if you don't find one, that's all right. That's very funny. That's very, very good. So what I'm saying about that is this. The parameter that we want to find is that biblical parameter in the middle where we say, okay, let's not be in denial about this thing, nor let's not be uncontrolled. Let's not be given over to. Let's not be poured out upon. Let's not be a slave to our appetites, especially the sexual appetite, because probably it's the most potent of our appetites. It's probably the most potent of our appetites. More damage is probably done by the inappropriate expression of sexuality than by the inappropriate expression of sleep or eating. In fact, it's literally deadly. But, you know, here's the interesting thing. It's not just deadly physically. The thing about sexuality that I always try to impress upon students is I really believe that we have really a dumbed down view of sexuality nowadays. And part of this has to do with popular cultural mores right now. So you have this sort of kind of peak of sexual oppression through the 1950s where you have the nice wifey at home. And you have the husband going off to work and no one's talking about sex or whether sex is good. And, you know, there's a sort of a cultural agreement that, you know, things that we see on internet pornography nowadays would just never happen. But on the other hand, there's no discussion at all. So a lot of sexual molestation and sexual abuse is being hidden. And there's a lot of sexual dissatisfaction among people because they don't have the freedom to talk about it. And so there's this backlash. When the boomers are young, when Bill Clinton's first on campus, there's this backlash against that sort of repressive sexual morality. And we have the sexual revolution. Now, the sexual revolution did do some good things, but if you look at it from a statistical point of view, there's more disease, death, hurt, and harm come out of the total unleashing of sexual morality than there probably any other social phenomenon in the last 200 years. And so what happens is sexuality gets this sort of little tag, and that is it's just natural. And by that, what we really mean is that sex is biological. And you know what? That's absolutely right. If you're going to make the argument sex is biological, it's normal, it's natural, it's nothing to be ashamed of, you're absolutely right. The thing that is not correct about that is that you can't stop there. Sex just isn't biological. Let's look at the biological part just for a second, though. Sex is about, essentially, both in the Bible and in our natural experience, sex is about reproduction. Now, this kind of gets ignored too much nowadays because the sensual side of sexuality is so popular nowadays. But listen to me, just because it gets ignored, it's not as cool, doesn't mean it's not as important. If you look at the Bible, the whole story of Abraham is about the story of reproduction. How God promises a man that he will be a father, and then how God deals with a man in that fatherhood. How God promises a woman she will be a mother, and how God deals with a woman in that motherhood. And not only is it just throughout the whole theme of this first kind of one-on-one relationship between God and a man called Abraham, but it exists to our day. You might be tempted to say, well, that whole emphasis on sex being about reproduction and sex not being about pleasure, but really about procreation, that's an old-fashioned thought. But I tell you what, sex is more about reproduction than almost anything else. And if it wasn't true, why is it that we spend so much money on fertility in our culture? I mean, I'm telling you, more research is being done on the issue of fertility than almost any other thing. And not only that, also our biggest ethical questions are surrounding the issue of fertility. Humans at the DNA level are highly, highly concerned about the issue of reproduction. Sex is biological on a level that none of us fully understand. It drives us on a level that none of us fully understand. And that is really intended by God. In fact, one of the things that bonds my wife and I together, makes us work as a team, gives us deep, deep life satisfaction, and is a pry for growth and maturity, is the fact that we have offspring together. That when I look at our children, I see her. When the Bible talks about us being one flesh, it's not just talking about sexual intercourse or some emotional state of intimacy. It's talking about Jesse, Maddie, and Emma, my kids. The chromosomes coming together and making one flesh. So sex is biological, but we can't stop there. This is the problem of the sexual revolution. It said sex is normal, it's natural, it's biological. The sexual urges you have are nothing to be ashamed of. Go for it. It stopped right there. It didn't also tell us this. Sex is also emotional. Most of us realize since the 1980s and the whole publicity of AIDS, and by the way, AIDS is only one of a list of sexually transmitted diseases that are defined now as epidemic proportion. Sexuality can also be called cultural, or I prefer to say it just simply this way, sex is emotional. Sex is not just biological. So when people say, oh, it's just sex, you know what I hate? I really hate this. I hate this movie that every once in a while Hollywood makes this movie, and it's the theme, the genre of the movie is The Happy Hooker. And what this is the pinnacle, of course, is Julia Roberts and Richard Gere in Pretty Woman. Pretty Woman. This is a pretty old movie now, but this is probably the pinnacle of this genre. You also have a movie called Night Shifts that's 10 years older than that, and you have Trading Places with Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd that's got this theme in it. And the idea is simply this. There is a lady, she's a hooker, but she is happy and proud to be a hooker. And it's just sex. It's just biological. And she makes a good living. And she's honest and she's clean and she helps people out. She's the happy hooker. Now, here's the little problem I have with this genre. I've actually worked with hookers. In fact, I have a sister who was caught in prostitution for about 15 years. There are no such thing as a happy hooker. Every time, I don't care if you're high dollar or you're a heroin addict on a corner of a street trying to turn a trick so you won't get sick. Every time someone gives their body in a sexual act, there is an emotional impact. One of the lines I like to use with students, and it's kind of corny but it's really true, is simply this. They don't make a condom strong enough for your heart. And that's really the issue. Sex is deeply cultural, deeply emotional. There is an emotional impact. When I get to the end of my life, let's say that I get to be 85 years old, let's hope so. I'm sure by then I'll be wearing my pants up to here. Have one of those flies that's that long. What? Who's the tailor for old men that makes those pants? He performs a valuable service. One of the things I like old people. And I can't wait to the day when I'm old. Because old people get to say whatever they want. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you're an idiot. You know? And I get to wear my pants right up to here. I had this old neighbor. He was incredible. He'd be like, Kurt, if you need a light bulb, I got a 2-year supply right here. That's why you need to go to Costco, get a 2-year supply of light bulbs. Any light bulb you need. I love that man. So anyway, the point is, he showed me his heart surgery. He's like, I had heart surgery. Right there it is, right there. But anyway, I get off the thing. Let's say that I get to 80 years old. I will have a lot of failure in my life. I will have a lot of things that I'll regret. I'm sure that if I put a catalog of the things I've done that are stupid, I'm sure that it's nothing compared to what I will do that's stupid. I know myself. But I want to say this. I will be able to look at my wife and say, only one person knows you the way I know you. And only you know me the way that you know me. To me, there is an emotional benefit to that level of intimacy. To know that there is one person in the world that knows me on that level. That would be a hugely smart thing. A hugely good thing. So sex is biological, sex is emotional. And the final thing, here's my premise. It's really not provable in sort of an empirical way, but I think that it's at least worth considering, and that's simply this. Sex is spiritual. That it goes beyond just the biological data of reproduction and urge and hormones. And it goes beyond even the emotional power that it has, but that sex is also a spiritual thing. Now, I base this on the fact that I trust the Bible. The Bible works. And here's what the Bible says. We have a relationship with the people that we're in sex with that bonds us to the point that we're literally one person with that person. And also, the Bible is very good about using sex in a way that says, that sex is a metaphor for our, get this, it's going to kind of shake your noodle, it's a metaphor for our relationship with God. Now, a lot of people tend to think that back in olden times, people were way more religious and they were way more nerdy about sexual ethics. That is really not true. North Americans really have a neurotic, you know, kingdomship over sex. There is a lot of sexual language in the Bible. And that sexual language simply says this. There is something deeply, deeply bonding and spiritual about sex. So much so that God would like to use it as a metaphor for how close He is with you. Now, those guys in the room that are a little bit homophobic might be uncomfortable with that. But it's really true. God wants to be that close to you. And when you engage in sexual activity with someone else, you are literally spirit touching spirit. You're communicating on a level that goes beyond information and beyond emotion. So then the question might come up, how do you handle sexuality then? How do you take this very potent thing that's biological and emotional and even perhaps spiritual? Well, I think that that gives us our whole scaffolding for trying to handle what we do with sexuality. I think the first thing you have to talk as far as redeeming sexuality and controlling lust is to have a really practical, physical sort of response to it. You know, a lot of lust has to do with fatigue. A lot of lust has to do with fatigue. When people get tired, they do stupid things. How many have ever done a stupid thing when you're tired? Those stupid things aren't just about, you know, I'm going to eat a whole pizza. Yes, me alone. And some chunky monkey from Ben and Jerry's. I'm eating the whole thing. Sometimes it's, I'm really tired and I'm bored and I'm frustrated and I'm going to turn on my computer and do something I know is wrong. Or I'm really tired and I'm really stupid because I'm tired. I get stupid when I'm tired. And so I'm going to put myself in a situation that even the most spiritual person in the world wouldn't be able to resist in that situation. And so part of being a person that wants to handle the power of sexuality correctly is taking care of yourself physically. Students all over America, I find, can learn incredible things and still not realize that sleep is mandatory to the human body. Second thing, I think you got to just know yourself. Some people in this room are listening to me right now and they're like, well, lust, big deal. Oh, well. That means probably you do not have a strong sex drive at this moment in your life. Other guys in this room are like, even talking about this topic is about to make me explode. You know? And I want to say this, for some women, it's even worse because, you know, we expect some guys to be sort of, you know, just on the edge of busting all the time. But if you're a gal who's got a strong sex drive, sometimes our culture doesn't look, you know, like there's something wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you. And God bless your husband. But you ought to know that about yourself. You ought to know that about yourself. And you ought to be really pragmatic and practical. I always used to tell my guys, Ephesians 5 says, don't there be a hint of sexual immorality among you. And so that's really our standard if you believe in the Bible. That's our standard. Don't let there be a hint of sexual immorality. So I was like, what's a hint of sexual immorality? I think that whenever you feel lust spilling over out of that parameter, then the moment you're feeling desire, get out of that parameter. That's your standard. So some people can be very, very touchy, and it's not a problem for them because there's no sexual content to it at all. Other people, and girls, you always know, women, you always know who these people are, don't you? You're sensitive to this. And that's a good thing. Guys, sometimes you don't realize it, but you're being sexual and you're not even realizing that you're going down that path. And I say, listen, I give one arm hugs. I do not engage in any sort of goofing around that has any sort of physical contact to it that could be in that area. I want to be above reproach in both my appearance and in action. And I do that because I've got a strong sex drive and I just want to be practical about that. And then all my friends be, that's the way I am too, because, you know, I got that sort of thing. Yeah. Because no one wants to say, yeah, I can touch anyone. I have no sex drive, you know. So first of all, I think there's some practical things. You know, when Nehemiah went to build the walls again, he didn't say, let's just pray that no one comes through those holes. I hope they don't come through. I hope. He was pragmatic. He was physical about it. He said, put a guard right there in that hole. Sometimes the way to do this is just to put a guard right there in that hole. And that is to get enough sleep, know yourself, arrange your schedule in a way that takes into granted that right now you are geared towards finding a mate and reproducing. That's your natural function in life right now. Second thing, and I'm moving around quickly, is you got to take emotional steps to protect you. And basically that comes in a twofold strategy too. First of all, you will not do stupid sins when someone else is watching. So this is what I recommend you do. Have someone else watch your life. Be an accountable person. Walk in the light as he is in the light is what Peter says. I do a thing on my computer where every website I visit gets emailed to my pastor and my wife. Just automatically, that list. And every time I'm on the net, I'm like, this is going to my pastor and my wife. And it helps. I have no, you know, then if I ever have to search for adult depend diapers, I don't have to have someone filtering out that site for me, because there's nothing wrong with adult depend diapers. You know, I might have a friend that needs those. But I can actually enter the word adult into Google and realize that I'm not going to be tempted to do anything stupid when that thing comes up, because my pastor and my wife will know if I click on that stupid site. So there needs to be some relationship in your life. There's several programs out there that could do that for you. The other thing I have to think on an emotional sense is that you have to find appropriate stress relief. A lot of sin has to do with inappropriate stress relief. And if you are not proactively engaging in appropriate stress relief, look at that, in the name of Jesus. If you're not engaging in appropriate stress relief, it's right here, 8. Is it still freaking?
Very slow. Just keep talking.
Okay. And so if you're not engaged in appropriate... here's what some of you need to do. You need to go down, and I talk quickly now because all this cajoling has got me off my track. Go down to your local Rite Aid. Get yourself one of those foam bats that kids use to play baseball in their backyard. Beat on your friends and your furniture with it. I believe in scream therapy. Find somewhere that you could just go and just scream. I believe in being honest when you pray. Please, do not pray these little things during finals week. Oh God, you have my future in your hands and just help me. Don't do that. When you're all by yourself, now when you're with people, you know, be nice, be cordial, but when you're all by yourself, just like, where are you? Where are you, God? Get it out. A lot of relief in the area of temptation can happen when you express stress. The Bible says, don't let the sun go down upon your anger. Get rid of all bitterness, anger, malice, and wrath. The Bible says, be quick to forgive. There is something about expressing and getting our stress out. And then finally, I want to talk about the spiritual side of this. There are really... The most important thing you can do to be a person who redeems sexuality and gets a healthy idea of sexuality about you is cultivate, and I want you to get this point, if you didn't hear anything else I said tonight and you're distracted by the screen, listen to this. This is extremely important. The engine of self-control, the fuel of self-control, is gratitude. Galatians goes through 3 chapters. Romans goes through even more material before Paul starts telling people what to do and what not to do. And the reason is Paul understands this. The greater your gratitude for the Lord, the greater your grace quotient, The greater you say, God, thank you, I didn't deserve that, the more likely you are to say no to inappropriate appetite, to sin. This will never make you more holy. This strategy. I'm going to show you a strategy that a lot of Christians employ, and it will not make you more holy. Here it is. Ready? I won't do it. I'm not going to do it. That will not. No. That's proven. It's been many studies. That is what's called self-power, self-will. It's this. I am on a diet. I want to lose weight. I want to be healthy. I'm not going to eat that cake. The cake in my refrigerator that my roommate brought, she said I could have a piece, will not eat it. I'm not going to eat the cake that's in there, the delicious and the chocolate, and then there's got another layer, it's a frosting I like. I will just only nibble, because nibbling is not eating. It is, technically, it's nibbling, and once I get a little taste, then I'll be done with that temptation, and a bite. What is there, 50 calories in a bite? A bite will help me, because then with a bite, it will be out of my resolve. Oh, God, that was good. I wonder if I eat my other roommate's piece, she'll know. You know, and then later on, you're like, I ate it because I didn't want my roommate to eat two pieces. I love her and she's on a diet. We will rationalize because we just know. The engine of holiness is this. Lord, because you love me, not because I deserved it, you brought relationship into my life. And not just relationship with the Lord, but I'm grateful for my wife. And let me tell you this, friends, self-control doesn't end after I do. In fact, once the spigot's turned on full force and you're in a loving relationship and you're used to the routine of sexual content in your life that's appropriate and good and wonderful, you probably need more self-control at that point. Most of us will. But what really, bottom line is, getting enough sleep, that really helps. Having appropriate stress relievers in my life, that really does help. Having accountability and friends that really know what I'm doing, that really helps. But when the push comes to shove and I'm tempted to express my sexuality in a harmful way, I think of really two people. I think of my Lord and my wife. And I'm grateful for both of those people in such a profound way that it's the most powerful motivation to keep me handling sexuality in a responsible way. Let's pray.